want to welcome everyone here this afternoon. Welcome to the Second Court of Appeals. I want to introduce your panel to you. To my right is Justice Elizabeth Kerr, and to my left is Justice Mark Pittman, and I'm Justice Bonnie Sutterth. We have one case for oral argument today, and if the clerk will call the case, we'll get started.
May it please the court. Good afternoon, Justice Kerr, Justice Pittman, and Chief Justice Southern. Congratulations. Welcome to the court. Not trying to curry favor, but I think it'd be inappropriate not to at least extend my congratulations.
Thank you.
My first year in law school, which was sadly many, many years ago, my favorite professor was a fellow named Robert Kent. He looked like a law professor. He was skinny and tall and had unkempt gray hair that he couldn't ever seem to keep combed. He had two jackets. He had a blue jacket with patches on the sleeves that he wore on warm days, and he had a gray jacket with patches on his sleeves that he wore on cold days. And after giving us 10 or 15 cases to read over the course of a weekend or the day before, he would invariably chide us because we always went to the exceptions whenever he asked us a question. And for the entire year that I had civil procedure with Professor Kent, he always impressed upon us, start with the rule. And those were his exact words every time you head down to the exceptions, start with the rule. I think that's important in this case because this case is about the rule, Rule 91A. Fortunately, it's a relatively new rule, so relatively few courts have passed opinions on it or written opinions on it. There's not a whole lot of jurisprudence to guide this court in what it does. You're effectively writing on a clean slate. I believe there's been one court out of this case, other way around, one case out of this court in which the court mentioned the rule, but there really was no discussion of how it would be applied in this context. In this particular case, my client, Bedford Internet Office Space, which I may refer to as BIOS, because that's how we refer to it in the office, and if I do, you'll know what I'm talking about, filed a lawsuit against its insurance company after denial of a claim. Once the federal court entered summary judgment on that claim, the client filed suit against the insurance agency selling it.
Yes, excuse me. Does your client disagree with the notion that a cause of action against an agent accrues when the claim is first denied by the insurer?
That goes straight to what I opened with. Start with the rule. The Supreme Court has made it very clear that a cause of action against an agent as a general proposition starts the day that the claim has been denied. And the Johnson and Higgins case was very clear about that. However, since Johnson and Higgins was handed down, there have been relatively few cases addressing different contexts where you have claims against the agent. And I suspect that's because you seldom have claims against the agent. The cases are typically resolved on the coverage side, and very few people actually pursue the agent for selling the wrong policy. One of the issues that's important to my client in this case is because of the application of Rule 91A, as opposed to a motion for summary judgment, which the defendant had available to it and could have filed the exact same day they filed their answer and had it set shortly thereafter, is that BIOS was denied the opportunity to present any exceptions to the Johnson and Higgins rule or to argue to any court anywhere that that rule should not apply for any reason.
Did your client not have the opportunity to do that in response to the motion to dismiss?
I don't believe so, Your Honor, because Rule 91A is very clear that no evidence may be considered. And I think that applies both to the plaintiff and the defendant. I think it would be inappropriate for the plaintiff to present evidence to the court, whether by affidavit. We're not permitted to do it through testimony, but I think it would be inappropriate and not called for under the rule for BIOS to present any evidence supporting any kind of exception, whether it be the Hughes tolling doctrine or the discovery rule or any other exception.
Well, even if your client lost on summary judgment, isn't the real question whether fees should shift?
That's an extremely important question because under Rule 91A, that is a remedy that the defendant has that the defendant does not have under Rule 166A. And bear in mind what Rule 91A was intended to prevent, and that is the claim that simply has no basis, not one that may be subject to a defense, but one that has no basis.
Well, so what would be an example of, you know, because Rule 91A, I confess to be a little mystified by exactly what it's supposed to address. Give me an example of a cause of action that has no basis in law. I mean, what could somebody plead where you go, aha, 91A is going to get me out of this?
Great question. I think I've set out three examples in our brief, and there are others in cases that have been cited in different contexts. For example, plaintiff brings a claim for negligent infliction of emotional distress. Court assumes that all the facts therein are true. There's still no claim because there is no claim in Texas for negligent infliction of emotional distress. Secondly, drunk driver runs a stoplight, barrels through the intersection, and doesn't hit me, but I sue anyway. That's a case where there is no cause of action. There are no facts that would support that cause of action. In the insurance context, and this is an example I set out in our brief, if the insurance company thoroughly investigated the claim and came to the conclusion that there was no coverage and the plaintiff simply disagreed, I don't think that's a cause of action that the plaintiff could sustain in court, because an honest disagreement about coverage is not something that Texas recognizes under either negligence theory or the insurance code. I'm sure there are other examples, but those are the three that came to me while we were briefing, at least.
Okay, so let me give a very simplistic example. Would you say then that if somebody, let's say, files a lawsuit over a car wreck, and in their petition they say, this car wreck occurred December 1st, 1988, and they file their lawsuit in 2017, and that's all we know. We have the file stamp date, and we have the date that the accident occurred. Are you saying that the defendant could not file a 91A motion? They'd have to go to summary judgment on limitations?
That's correct, Your Honor. 91A.
And is that because they have you're required to affirmatively plead affirmative defense as a defendant? Otherwise, the plaintiff gets to recover on something that's barred by limitations?
That's exactly right. If I file in one of the interesting cases that was cited, I forget whether it was in my brief or the defendant's brief, the plaintiff waited 30 years to file a claim. So obviously, you can wait forever. And we see this in credit card cases all the time. Credit card collection companies file cases, a pro se answer doesn't file a statute of limitations defense, and they lose, because that's what the law in Texas says. Rule 94 sets out affirmative defenses.
Yet the trial court here was precluded from looking at the defensive pleadings make his decision. So he has to, in essence, be blindfolded to whether or not an affirmative defense was pled or not.
I completely agree. If the affirmative defense is not, first of all, the rule and the statute behind the rule preclude reference to anything other than the plaintiff's pleadings. So the court could, and frankly should, take that pleading and read it and determine if everything in this pleading is true, do I have a cause of action? And they cannot look at an affirmative defense. One reason that jurisdiction is different, and there's some cases cited by the defendant on jurisdiction, is because the plaintiff has the burden of pleading jurisdiction.
You're talking about the Dallas case?
That's exactly right, Your Honor. In that case, I believe that was the one where City of Dallas, it was a sovereign immunity case. You have to plead an exception to the sovereign immunity statute in order to get into court at all. That is very different from an affirmative defense, which the defendant has to raise, and if they don't raise it, it's waived. And from a burdensome or procedural posture, there's no extra burden on the defendant by requiring them to file their pleading under the correct rule. Because this same pleading could have been filed with minor modifications under Rule 166A. It could have been filed at the same time. There's no prohibition in the rule against filing a 166, any motion for summary judgment, with your answer. It's rare that it happens, but it can be done. This rule was set out to analyze, in my opinion, after reading the rule and the history, to look at the plaintiff's claim, the petition only. If the facts alleged in the petition are true, does it state a claim? If the answer is yes, 91A is not available. And if the answer is no, obviously, then they can be dismissed. And the purpose of this statute was to weed out only the most frivolous and unmeritorious claims. A lot of the claims that come before the courts are prisoner appeals, and one of the cases cited in these briefs was a prisoner appeal. The issue was he was trying to get the conviction set aside, but he had not been exonerated. And that's a case where the court said, on its face, you cannot proceed because you did not meet one of the key elements. Exoneration is not the exact right term, but when you're trying to have expungement, that's what it is, not exoneration. You have three elements. You have not pled one of them, and you've affirmatively pled that you were not exonerated. Therefore, you're never going to get, no matter what happens, you're never going to have your conviction expunged. So what I'm here to suggest to this court is, because this is a new rule, you don't have to take opinions from Corpus Christi and Houston and San Antonio and Dallas and try to put them all together and try to make them all make sense, even though, as we all know as judges who've been as attorneys who've been practicing for a while, you rarely can do that. You have the opportunity to state up front in the first case that's come before this court squarely on this issue, affirmative defenses simply are not appropriate for Rule 91A. That's a very clean, bright-line rule that no attorney's going to have to argue about. They can still bring 166 motions, but they cannot bring 91A motions. And if the court looks at the results that might ultimately happen in this case, then you're going to create the possibility for any number of cases down the road to come in and argue about the minutia of what the court really meant when it allowed an affirmative defense to be adjudicated under 91A.
Counsel, let me stop you for a sec. One of the things, as you pointed out numerous times, is there's not a dearth of opinions out there interpreting Rule 91A. Some of the opinions say that Rule 91A is akin to the Texas's version of Federal Rule 12b-6. Are you aware, in the context in federal court under Rule 12b-6, of cases being brought under Rule 12b-6 under similar circumstances where we have an allegation that on the pleadings themselves, there's an indication that the case has been filed past the statute of limitations deadline?
I have not seen a limitations case. I believe the defendant cited one case where an affirmative defense was at issue, but I don't think it was a limitations case. And most of the cases that were cited in the brief and that I've seen in researching were of the jurisdictional nature. You have not pled.
In other words, typically Rule 12b-6 is not used in federal courts on the basis of a statute of limitations issue. Is that right?
That's correct. That's Rule 56, I believe, in federal court. And that actually raises an important point. The Texas legislature, when it instructed the Supreme Court to pass a rule dealing with baseless motions or baseless pleadings, they were not writing on a clean slate. The federal rules of civil procedure have been around for close to 100 years now, and 12b-6 has been one of them. Ironically, Professor Kent's softball number was 12b-6. That has nothing to do with the appeal. I just thought that was ironic. But the Texas legislature could have adopted 12b-6 flat out without involving the Supreme Court. They could have instructed the Supreme Court to adopt 12b-6. The Supreme Court, which, as you know, appoints a committee to come up with a rule, and then the committee brings it to the Supreme Court, any of those two bodies, or either of those two bodies, could have adopted 12b-6. They didn't. They put out a rule that literally takes two pages of the Texas Rules of Civil Procedure and has numerous subsections, 9, I believe. Therefore, I don't think it was the Supreme Court's intent to adopt the case law behind 12b-6. Certainly, you can analogize the two, but I don't think it's appropriate to do so. I think the Texas Supreme Court and the Rules Committee that drafted this rule has set forth, frankly, a much clearer rule than 12b-6 is. I'm at the yellow. If you have any questions, Your Honors, I'm happy to answer, but I think we've addressed the key issues otherwise.
Thank you.
Thank you, Judges.
May it please the court. So the question here today is whether the trial court properly dismissed this case on a 91A motion based on Bedford's pleadings. And I think the best way to approach answering that question is to break it up into a general question and a more specific question directed towards Bedford's pleadings. The first, more general question is whether under the no basis in law prong of Rule 91A, a claim may be dismissed when the allegations in the complaint trigger a legal bar to recovery. The more specific question is whether Bedford's claims, as pleaded, have no basis in law because the pleadings themselves demonstrate that the claims have been filed outside the limitations period. Now, I would submit to the court that the answer to both of those questions is yes. Rule 91A, in particular the no basis in law language, which is the operative language in this appeal, states a cause of action has no basis in law if the allegations taken as true, together with the inferences reasonably drawn from them, do not entitle the claimant to the relief sought. Now, as appellant has pointed out, this landscape of Rule 91A cases is still developing, and this court, with the exception of the opinion in Drake versus Chase Bank, has not really spoken on 91A. But the courts of appeals that have addressed it have been surprisingly consistent in this no basis in law prong. And just this year, the Corpus Christi Court of Appeals in Reeves versus City of Corpus Christi, a case cited in appellant's brief, 518 Southwest 3rd, 594, discussed the two categories of cases that fit into the no basis of law prong. Those cases are cases where the petition alleges too few facts to state a legally cognizable claim, or I think another example would be a petition that clearly alleges a claim that the Texas Supreme Court has ruled doesn't exist in Texas, so negligent infliction of emotional distress or false light, something along those lines. The second category of cases are cases where the petition alleges facts that, if true, trigger a legal bar to recovery, or put another way, that the pleadings affirmatively negate the right to relief. So this is one of the second category of cases. And although appellants have suggested that you cannot get a 91A motion to dismiss based on an affirmative defense, the case law bears a completely different answer to that question. So the courts of appeals that have considered this have dismissed or affirmed the dismissal of cases under 91A on defensive issues. In fact, the first two major cases, GoDaddy and Woolley, both involved, Woolley versus Schaefer, both involved affirmative defenses. Woolley versus Schaefer involved the Peeler Doctrine, which is an affirmative defense that a criminal defense counsel can assert when a malpractice claim is filed by a criminal convict who's not been exonerated. GoDaddy involved the application of an immunity defense under the Communications Decency Act. The Amarillo Court of Appeals has addressed the statute of limitations issue specifically in 91A in Parkhurst versus the Office of the Attorney General. That case is cited in our brief. And in that case, the plaintiff filed a bill of review seeking to overturn a summary judgment that had been entered in July of 2010. The bill of review was filed in October of 2014. AG filed a motion to dismiss on statute of limitations and other grounds. And the Amarillo Court of Appeals said, we're going to affirm the dismissal because the statute of limitations based on the pleadings has clearly run. And there was no dispute in that case, just as there is no dispute in this case, as to what those four-year statute of limitations applied to the bill of review. Here, a four-year statute of limitations applies to Bedford's breach of contract claim and 2-year to the negligence claims and DTPA and insurance claims.
I would like to ask you the same question.
Sure.
Appellant's counsel. In the context of federal courts, Rule 12b-6, is statute of limitations something that is brought up in a motion to dismiss under Rule 12b-6 when arguably it's obvious from the pleadings that the case is time barred?
Yes, Your Honor, and I'm not sure. I don't have a case that I can cite you to in my notes here, but there are occasions where 12b-6 has resulted in a dismissal of a case based on statute of limitations when it's demonstrated in the pleadings that the limitations period is run. And as far as, you know, is 12b-6 instructive here, or, you know, did the Texas Supreme Court intend to impose a 12b-6 sort of standard, I agree with appellant that if the Texas Supreme Court had wished to impose the 12b-6 standard, they would have used that language. But I think the court and the bar recognize that Texas has notice pleadings, and within that context, you know, that meant that 91A needed to have some different language to address when a cause of action was going to be groundless, either.
Well, you're correct. In Texas, unlike the federal system, we do have notice pleadings, which would seem to indicate that we shouldn't as strictly enforce Rule 91A as the federal courts do 12b-6. Isn't that right?
I mean, I think that the courts trial courts and courts of appeal need to enforce 91A as it's written. So if considering the pleadings and taking all the allegations in the pleadings
no,
is true.
No, it's not considering the pleadings. It's considering only the plaintiff's pleadings.
Yes, Your Honor, I misspoke. Considering the plaintiff's pleading, taking all of the allegations as true, and any reasonable inferences drawn from them, do those pleadings plead the plaintiff out of court? That's
and
the question.
Do you think it's a reasonable inference that statute of limitations will be raised in a defensive pleading? Is that does that qualify as a reasonable inference? Because that's the inference that has to be made if you're only going to look at the plaintiff's pleadings.
Well, the court also needs to look at the motion and the legal basis for the argument that a claim has no basis in
law. So you're allowed to backdoor in the defensive pleadings by arguing in your motion that in your defensive pleading you raised statute of limitations?
Your Honor, I'm not sure that you need to backdoor in any fact. The fact that needs to be assumed or the fact that needs to be adopted for the purposes of considering the 91A motion is what is pled in the plaintiff's pleadings. If a legal bar exists, the case law supports dismissal of the claim under 91A, regardless of whether it's
been pleaded in a defensive pleading or not. If the legal bar is an affirmative defense, it has to be pleaded in a defensive pleading or it is waived, right?
In practice, that is true, yes.
Otherwise, they could recover fully for it if it wasn't in the pleadings. Under the current law.
Your Honor, I believe at a certain point, a defendant, even if affirmative defense had not been pleaded in their answer, they could raise it in the trial proceeding.
If it was tried by consent or something like that. But barring that kind of exception, if it's not in the pleadings, you don't get the benefit of it. And a plaintiff can fully recover.
I'm not sure that that's entirely true, Your Honor. If you're filing a motion for summary judgment on an affirmative defense, it's sufficient to raise that in the motion for summary judgment.
But in a motion for summary judgment, you're not precluded from looking at other pleadings, and you're basing it on the evidence that's presented at the summary judgment in the summary judgment context, not on the pleadings. 91A is pleading intensive. You look only at the plaintiff's pleadings.
You do look only at the plaintiff's pleadings, and you look at the motion and the legal issues that are raised. I think the same thing would be true in a summary judgment context. If a defendant didn't plead statute of limitations in their answer, but they wanted to raise a limitations issue in their motion, they would raise the issue in their motion, and they would say that the claim was legally barred, time barred, and then the court could consider that motion and the pleadings and any summary judgment evidence before them if summary judgment evidence would illuminate that issue. Here, based on the plaintiff's pleadings, I'm not sure what summary judgment evidence Texas Insurance Group could have brought forward. There is pleaded the date of the denial of the insurance coverage of the insurance claim. Johnson & Higgins expressly states that accrual occurs when the claim is denied. There's no allegation that there was any wishy-washiness from the insurance company or indication that denial wasn't clear.
Your client didn't have to plead it as an affirmative defense. You could have gone to trial without it as an affirmative defense.
Your Honor, if our client wanted to assert that defense going forward and to use that defense in the trial, they would have had to plead it at some point, either in their answer or raising it in a summary judgment motion or perhaps at the trial with a consent. I believe it was appropriate to bring up the issue in the 91A motion. You've got multiple courts of appeals, and obviously those are all just persuasive authority for this court, but multiple courts of appeals affirming dismissals of 91A motions based on issues that are generally thought of as defensive when the appellant pleads facts that raise or trigger that bar to relief. And I think this is a clear case of that. Just to turn back for a moment to the Reeves case from Corpus Christi that I was discussing, that case actually has a very thorough, analysis of 91A, its development, and its progress since it became a rule in March of 2013. And they cite to In re Essex, which is the one Texas Supreme Court case we have. Now, the Texas Supreme Court didn't provide a lot of guidance in terms of how exactly to apply 91A, but I think it provides a really good example of the a similar issue to what you're talking about here. In Essex, the plaintiff sued Essex Insurance Company directly, but had not gotten a judgment against the insured. And Essex raised the issue in their 91A motion of the no direct action rule, which is a bar to suing the insurance company until there has been a decision as to the liability against the insured. And in a mandamus, the Texas Supreme Court reversed the trial court that had denied the 91A motion and dismissed the cause of action dismissed the plaintiff's claims because they ran contrary to the direct action rule, which was a bar to relief.
Isn't the real issue here, because you could have raised a summary judgment motion, isn't the real issue here fee shifting? Because by using 91A, you get attorney's fees and costs and so forth. Whereas if you'd raised it as summary judgment, you simply would have perhaps won and gone on your way. Isn't that really at the crux of this?
Your Honor, no. I think the crux of it is what is an appropriate motion or what is an appropriate avenue for seeking dismissal for a defendant. Early in a case, 91A is available. The summary judgment rule is, as a practical matter, one that is going to involve additional delay for a defendant.
Not if it's on your own affirmative defense. You can raise that at any time. What's the answer once you've appeared?
Your Honor, you can raise that at any time.
It wouldn't be a no evidence because you bear the burden of proof, and therefore you don't have to wait for adequate time for discovery. You could file it with your answer.
Your Honor, that's absolutely true. I'm speaking more as a practical matter as a defendant. It's very difficult to get summary judgment, even a traditional summary judgment, early in a case, whereas 91A is expressly designed to be to be filed within 60 days of the pleading and to be handled within 45 days of that. I did want to speak, and Your Honor, I'll just say as an aside, I'm not sure that the fee-shifting issues really have been raised in appellant's brief.
But it's the only essential difference between the two in this circumstance.
I can't disagree with you on that, Your Honor. And I want to turn just for a moment in the brief time I have left to those statute of limitations issues. As I've already said, settled law dictates when a cause of action against an insurance agent involving accrual occurs. There was nothing pleaded in Bedford's pleadings to toll those limitations or extend those limitations, and the discovery rule, according to Johnson and Higgins, doesn't apply when the denial has been clear and the insurance company's denial of coverage has been clear and expressed.
Do you think that in response to your 91A motion that the plaintiff could or should have amended their petition if they had some facts to raise application of the discovery rule or, you know, fraudulent concealment or whatever mechanisms they might have had available? Do you think that they should have used 91AB to do that?
Yes, Your Honor. I think the rule expressly contemplates that if there are facts that would support the grounds for the case, that you would amend your pleadings prior to the hearing on the 91A motion. Do the justices have any additional questions for me? Okay, then I've completed my time. Thank you. We ask that you affirm.
I'd like to address two issues briefly. On the Drake case, which is the case out of this court from December of 2014, that was not a statute of limitations case. It was not an affirmative defense case. That's the case where the individual is seeking something in the nature of expungement, but I believe he sued his attorney for malpractice. And one of the elements of the claim, and I'm looking at the reading from the opinion, Drake pleaded a claim against Chase for irreparable harm to his credit. So this had nothing to do with the expungement, alleging that Chase had reported debts of which he was unfamiliar on his credit bureau. And the court wrote in its opinion that you have to assert a claim. You have to assert a DTPA claim or slander of credit or something like that. This was not an affirmative defense situation. This was a case in which the plaintiff had simply pled something that doesn't exist as a cause of action in Texas, like negligent infliction of emotional distress. And the second issue I wanted to address is the policy issue, which I think this court is focused on. This rule was passed for a very specific and very limited purpose. We have Rule 166A and C. Both of those have hundreds of, 166AI has 20 years of case law. I still refer to the 1999 rules as the new rules. But the Rule 166AC has 100 years of precedent behind it. We don't need to cram into Rule 91A what can be done under Rule 166. And the fee shifting is critically important. And the amendment of pleadings is important. You don't need to do all that and shouldn't have to do all that under Rule 91A. That's to put a stake through the heart of claims that simply don't exist.
Well, but you had their Rule 91A motion saying that the face of your pleadings showed that the claim was time barred. In this limited factual situation, I mean, wouldn't it have been prudent to, because I believe you said in your opening argument that perhaps the claim against the insurance agent would not have been time barred or wouldn't have accrued simply by the denial of coverage by the insurer. So isn't that why 91A5B exists, is so that a plaintiff can avoid maybe getting a motion to dismiss granted against it by adding facts for the court to consider?
If I'm following Your Honor's question.
Sorry, it was bad.
No, I apologize if I wasn't following correctly. Paragraph 13 of the original petition alleges the discovery rule.
Right.
Which the plaintiff is precluded from defending or proving under Rule 91A. Simply can't do it. Evidence is not permitted. And the discovery rule is implicated once the defendant has proven the affirmative defense, and then the burden shifts to the plaintiff to prove the defense, whether it be that one which was pled or Hughes or any other rule that might be available. If the court has nothing further, I would simply urge the court to enforce the rule as it is written. It is clearly worded, easy to understand, easy for lawyers to apply, and easy for courts to apply. You have the opportunity, having not written on this issue before, to draw a bright line in the sand, and we urge the court to reverse the decision below and hold that an affirmative defense simply cannot be adjudicated under Rule 91A. There's no reason for it. We have other procedures. And I appreciate the court's attention. Thank you.
Counselors, your case has now been submitted, and you